This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. North Carolina is central to the work of Arwin Smallwood. He specializes in the state's colonial and early antebellum periods. He's part of North Carolina's Historical Society, and he's been working on a project to digitize the state's slave deeds for 5 years. Last summer, he brought a group of students to Eastern North Carolina to share research on slavery. The project worked to connect the public to history that helped build their communities. But there's one part of the state that is especially important to Arwin Smallwood. It is a rural 10-square-mile town called Indian Woods. It's where he grew up, and it's the subject of his doctoral dissertation. Arwin Smallwood's a professor and chair of the Department of History and Political Science at North Carolina A&T State University and joins me now. Arwin Smallwood, welcome back. Good to talk with you.
Thank you. Good to be back.
Tell us about Indian Woods, where you grew up. Tell us more about that town.
Well, it's really a rural farming community more so than a town, and the closest town to it would be Windsor, which is the county seat. And it's not a very large county. I think if you were to look at the community, what you would see is that...
We may have lost that connection, I think, with Arwin Smallwood in Bertie County. He's talking about the 10-square-mile area known as Indian Woods, a fascinating region of northeastern North Carolina in Bertie County. The racial makeup is also interesting. Native American, European, and African American. A lot of mixing has gone on in that area, rural area still today. And it became the subject of Arwin Smallwood's research as he looked into not only the slave deeds, but also the ways in which those communities came together and formed a unique part of the corner of the state of North Carolina. We're going to talk about his history. He wasn't always going to be a historian. He is now at North Carolina A&T State. Hey, welcome back. Good to have you.
Yes, I'm sorry. It's... The technology, a disconnect. I apologize.
Well, it's great to have you back. So I was just at least laying out the Wikipedia entry for Indian Woods. But tell us more about that area and what it was like when you grew up.
Well, Indian Woods was actually a native reservation. It was a reservation given to the Tuscarora Indians in 1717. After the colonial war between North Carolinians and the Tuscarora Nation. And since that time, it was served as a reservation, and then land was leased to farmers. And so it's pretty much been a farming community since the 1700s and into the 1800s. And so, of course, I grew up there in the 70s and 80s, at least my formative years were in the 70s and 80s. But my family is from there for hundreds of years, and both my mother's family and father's family, grandparents, great-grandparents, all grew up in that community. So it's really a rural farming community, self-sufficient. The landscape provided much of what people needed, fishing, if we talk about fruits and vegetables from gardens, strawberries, blackberries, mulberries, plums, pears, peaches. So it was just an abundant landscape. And those are the things that I remember growing up in the 70s in the community, was that it was an abundant landscape.
And what about that family history? You said it went way back. Were you always aware of it? Was it something people were always talking about?
It was, that's a yes and a no. My grandfather would tell me stories. And since he farmed and had farmed all his life and, of course, inherited that from his father and grandfather, he made a point of showing us the farms. We worked the land with him, and he made a point of showing us, where our grandparents, great-grandparents were buried, and then telling us stories about his grandfather and the people who lived in the community. But for the most part, I think most of the people in the community took their existence for granted. We were family, and all of the families had been there and been from there for hundreds of years. They all knew each other well. They were all interrelated. And so we took our existence for granted. You know, this was home.
You
know,
talked
and
about
this is the home place.
Yeah, your grandfather and his farm. You worked on that farm, right?
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. We helped my grandfather. He didn't use initially a lot of poisons. You know, a lot of herbicides. You know, and they were transitioning. So we would actually walk the fields. And when he planted corn, soybeans, peanuts, we would chop out the weeds and the crabgrass. So I had four, you know, all together is five of us, but they're two sisters and two brothers. My youngest brother is 10 years behind me, and I was the youngest child, so he really didn't get to experience much of this. But we would often go and remove the weeds and the crabgrass from my grandfather's fields. We would drive, you know, drive to the different fields,
yeah.
Work the fields. And so it was just a great experience.
Well, was it a great experience at the time? I mean, were you thinking to yourself, as soon as I can, I'm getting out of here? Or did you, I mean, how did you feel about it at the time?
Again, a mixed feeling, because having that opportunity to walk those fields and knowing that your ancestors had walked those fields, when you got out of the fields to the edge of the rows on the edge of the forest, I mean, you could sit under a shade tree. It was hard work. I think anyone who grew up on a farm would say it's definitely difficult work. And for many people, yes, it's a motivator to go to college or to go on and do other things. So I won't say it did not motivate me and my siblings to go on to, you know, do other things. But it, again, with that being said, being able to walk in the sand, feel the dirt in the sand, you know, it was sandy farmland that my grandfather farmed, and smell the dirt and the crops. I mean, it's a sensation, it's a feeling that has been with me my entire life, and it's been hard to shake that feeling and that desire to get back to North Carolina and to go back as often as I can to just walk the fields, you know, just to go and see. It's always, you know, in the spring when they're planting crops and they're plowing up the fields, it's a great feeling.
Well, we'll talk more about how your career did bring you back, but I want to hear more about your childhood, because you've said that your mom was very protective of you. Why was that?
Well, I had been born prematurely. I talked to my mother later, and she told me about this later. But I had been born prematurely, and so she was always concerned about me, and that's my vision, you know. My retinas were stretched, or, you know, and they were at risk of detaching. And so she was always very concerned about me playing sports or doing anything, any kind of rough play, because she was worried about my vision. And then when I was about four, I also had pneumonia, and I nearly died. And so she was very concerned about, you know, me in particular, because of my, you know, my conditions.
Right.
And so I ended up spending a great deal of time with her, and so I ended up traveling with her. So when she would go to visit the older people in the community, to either barter with them, you know, bring them eggs or bring them hams or, you know, preserves, and they would have different things that she might want, you know, collards or cabbages or tomatoes or whatever. I just got a chance to see these older people. And at that time, they were in their 70s and 80s, sometimes in their 90s. But I got to see people that you would not normally see, because young people are often doing what young people do, you know?
Well, a rare insight. Yeah, as you say, a rare insight for a child, not only to see that, but also the connection. Your mother's making the connection. And when they're talking about all these. So you can start to feel that web that, again, I think a younger person generally doesn't get to have.
That's right. And then even then, a lot of young people, of course, would prefer, you know, just playing, which, of course, I enjoyed playing with my cousins and my siblings as well. But there was something about sitting and hearing the older people tell these stories. Some of them would be ghost stories. Some of them would just be stories about the old days. But hearing them tell those stories and being on those old farms, you know, and near those old farmhouses with chickens and ducks and geese, it was just, you know, it was just a good experience. I enjoyed having the opportunity to do that. And some of my siblings, I know my younger brother missed that completely. And some of my siblings missed that.
One of the values that you've said really came through to you in this community was not putting on airs. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, we're poor rural farming people, right? So everyone was, you know, family. And if they weren't immediate family, we all treated each other as kin. So someone who may not be an aunt, you know, we would call them aunt, you know. So everyone basically was the same, and everyone wanted to look after everyone and make sure that everyone was the same. And so with putting on airs, I mean, you know, oftentimes, you know, people, you know, want to either show off their affluence, you know, by having brand new cars or fancy clothes or a huge house or whatever. Or they may, you know, not have really the resources for those things, but they give the impression, the air that they have those things. Either way, it was often seen by my family as showing off. And even if people did own land or, you know, own their own farms, my grandfather did own his own farm, people tended to be very modest in terms of, you know, how they presented themselves and how they interacted with others. And so it's just, you know, it became a part of my culture. My wife and I actually were having that discussion earlier today about even now I feel uncomfortable. If, you know, if I get a rental car or something and it's something fancy, I don't feel comfortable. And I just, you know, because it's...
You don't roll down the windows when it's 90 degrees out there just to show you don't have air conditioning. You're not that guy. I'll tell you what, let's take a break here. Arwin Smallwood is a professor and chair of the Department of History and Political Science at North Carolina A&T, and we're going to continue our conversation on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Arwin Smallwood is my guest today. He's a professor and chair in the Department of History and Political Science at North Carolina A&T. He's written several books, including Bertie County and Eastern Carolina History. And he's done extensive research on the relationships between indigenous, African, and European people in North Carolina. But Arwin did not see himself as a historian when he was growing up in rural Indian Woods. He really didn't even plan to go to college until he was close to graduating from high school. Arwin, talk about the racial makeup of that part of North Carolina.
Well, northeastern North Carolina, just as a region, has the highest concentration of, or eastern North Carolina, then northeast, the highest concentration of African Americans in the state. And then my county, Bertie County, is well over 60% African American. And then Indian Woods, where I grew up, was pretty much 98-99% African American. There are a few there are a few white families that were older families that were dying out that were still on a couple of farms. But, you know, if you were to look at the census records, you know, pretty much from the 1960s to now, you wouldn't see more than just a handful of one or two white families living in the community. They still owned land and still farmed, but they didn't actually live in Indian Woods.
And it was, as you said, not originally, but at one time, part of the Tuscarora Reservation. So what is any part of the native population in that part of North Carolina?
Well, the Tuscarora stayed on the reservation from 1717 until 1802. And in 1802, there was a slave uprising, which was called the Great Slave Conspiracy, and it was considered the worst planned slave insurrection in the history of the state of North Carolina. And the Tuscaroras that were there were accused of working with many of the African Americans, who were mixed bloods, by the way, because many Native people were enslaved, and many of the Tuscaroras had their women and children taken in that from the reservation and enslaved on local plantations. And so it was... you know, again, it was a community that had mixed people, you know, people who had clearly Indian ancestry, African and European ancestry, but we considered ourselves African-American.
And what about that growing up? I mean, were you aware of that at all, that mixed race, the history itself, the story itself, or was that not really a part of your consciousness growing up?
The mixture was obvious. I mean, you have families, if I mention, you know, Rascals, Freemans, you know, Williams, Bonds, you know, my own family, Smallwoods, I mean, Pews, I mean, all of these families, you know, you had African Americans with green eyes, blue eyes, gray eyes, who are fair skin, some with dark skin with blue eyes. I mean, it was clear that the community had a long mix. And since we were so, you know, known each other for such a long time and the families had been, you know, interacting for such a long time, you knew there was no immediate white mixture, you know, because you knew these people's, you knew their parents, you knew their grandparents, you knew their great grandparents. So you knew the mixture had to have come in pretty far back. So that part was obvious, but we took it for granted because we were all family. You know, we grew up together. We were either kids, cousins, or we were just close family and friends. And so no one really questioned it. And then when people say, "Well, you know, Grandma looks Indian," and then they said it was Cherokee, you know, because Cherokee is the group that most North Carolinians identify with. You know, they identify Cherokees, but very few people know very much at all about Tuscaroras. So it wasn't until later, until college, that I realized that where I was living was a Tuscarora reservation. And so I began the process of trying to find out more about those Indians because I'd never heard of them in the county, there on that in that community, or you know, in throughout the state. I don't you don't didn't hear very much about the Tuscaroras at that time.
Well, before you launched your academic career, you thought you were going to go into the military. Talk about that and how you imagined that was going to be your future.
Well, for most people, many people who are coming from, you know, poor backgrounds, you know, at least in my community, the military was a great career. I mean, you know, they had great health care. You know, the pay was good. Certainly, there was opportunity for, you know, wars and a person being injured or killed in war. But in that community, as I mentioned before, my great-great-grandfather fought in the Civil War, and so his brothers and their other kinfolk in that community who had fought for the Union during the Civil War and pretty much had fought in all of America's wars. The best troops from Eastern North Carolina fought in the Indian campaigns out in the West. They fought in World War I, World War II. If you go to the churches, you'll see the markers for all of the individuals that served. My great uncle served in World War II. He fought in the Pacific. So that was kind of a tradition that, you know, serving in the military, most of these soldiers, when they came home, brought those resources back to the community. And they used them as early as the Civil War to build schools and to build churches. And if they, after, in World War I, you know, with those resources that they got from the military, they bought, you know, trucks. And they always shared, you know, farm equipment, trucks. Flatbed trucks were used to transport the kids to school. They were like early school buses. So it was just a very close-knit community. And so going into the military, that was seen as a way of, if you went and came back to the community, you know, people just knew people who had served and who, you know, were part of the military, or if you could use the military to leave the community and see the world and have a good life.
So you were thinking the Air Force, right?
Yeah, so my story is this. You know, most high schools, recruiters will come around and, you know, try to recruit high school students. And many students take, I think it's called the ASVAB, which is a, you know, placement test for the military. And so when I took the ASVAB, along with many other kids in my class, you know, my scores came back and the recruiter met with me and said, "Well, your scores are very high." And he said, "I think that you should go to college and be an officer." And I'd never thought about doing that before, but that was the first time that that idea was planted. So that recruiter, because based on my scores, thought that I would make a good officer. And so that's when I really started to think about college. Now, I had been thinking about college through Upward Bound, which, you know, I could talk about more too, but that was another, you know, kind of a push about considering going to college.
Well, talk about Upward Bound. That's a fascinating program. We've had Frank Stevenson on this program talking about that, and so maybe you can tell us more about that program and how it influenced you.
Well, Frank Stevenson, you know, just has had a tremendous impact on my life, and I have to say, you know, I speak highly of him whenever I'm given the opportunity. But you know, he's run the Upward Bound program, I think he said now, for almost 40 years. And his Upward Bound program encompasses several counties in eastern North Carolina, including Bertie, and if I'm not mistaken, it is Hertford and Northampton counties. And you know, it's been a very successful program. I think one of the most successful Upward Bound programs in the country.
And what does it do for people who don't know what Upward Bound is? Maybe just a brief summary.
Well, the bottom line is that it exposes young people to things that they would never be exposed to. It takes them to plays. It takes them to historic sites, to universities. You know, most young people in eastern North Carolina, I know I had not really gone too many places beyond the rural areas in eastern North Carolina. In fact, I say this to people sometimes. We went to Virginia sometimes, but I didn't know that North Carolina had any cities of any real significance until roughly college, because you know, in these trips that we used to take you know, high school, these trips we used to take with Upward Bound. I just, you know, because Eastern North Carolina is pretty rural. Greenville
Right.
would be one of the bigger cities, and maybe Right. Wilmington if you got that far south. But the point of the program is to expose you to things that you wouldn't be exposed to. And it did, and also help you understand financial aid, help you understand how to apply for college, because many people in rural areas, they've not been exposed to those things and don't understand necessarily how to do those things, nor their parents
and
who have
you
not
did,
been to college.
And you did apply to college. Talk about the application process and where you ended up.
Well, I also tell that story as well. You know, I applied to seven schools. I applied to East Carolina, to NC State, Chapel Hill, even to A&T and UNC Charlotte, UNC Greensboro. And only one school accepted me, and that was North Carolina Central. So I always, you know, even though I work at North Carolina A&T and think very highly of North Carolina A&T, I always have to say that North Carolina Central gave me an opportunity that no other school had given me. And I tried to take advantage of that opportunity. And so I always, you know, talk about the impact that Central and the professors there at Central had on my life and my professional development.
But at this point, you're going to Central, going to college at all, so that you can get enough academic training to be an officer in the Air Force. And then things turned out the way things turned out. You didn't actually get into the Air Force, right?
That's correct. Yeah, I mean, the Soviet Union collapsed, and once it collapsed, the need for, you know, military personnel was a lot less. And so any imperfections that were being waived early on were no longer being waived. And so my vision, you know, again, like I said, I'm legally blind. You know, I was not able to get a waiver for that anymore. And so I had to really think about what else could I do, because that avenue, you know, was now shut off. But I will say that the experiences I got from taking the leadership training, I think really did help me and has, you know, really prepared me, or really did prepare me for more advanced study and for just interacting with people in general. So every experience, you know, was a building block to where I am today. To tell a short story, so once I had that, you know, that happened and I didn't know what to do next, I was sitting on the steps of what's now the Helen Edmonds Building at North Carolina Central, and the then chair of the department, Dr. Percy Murray, was coming back from lunch, and he saw me sitting on the steps, and he asked me, I seemed to be dejected, I guess, and he said, what was wrong? And I said, well, it's no big, you know, nothing. He said, no, something's wrong. Come to my office and tell me what's going on. And so he took me into his office. I explained my situation, and he handed me an application for the master's program in history. He said, you look like a smart young man. Fill out this application and come get your master's degree in history in our department. And my undergraduate degree was in political science. So I'd gotten my undergraduate degree in political science, but this was my first exposure, immersion into history, to be really immersed into history.
This, by the way, I don't want to talk more about, you know, your transition into history and whether or not you'd considered that, but just to underscore this moment is, I think, what I've heard from a lot of people who went to HBCUs about the reason they went there and why they feel so strongly about it, that close-knit community and that real bond that they could create with professors and the rest of their community that helped them through. Is that a fair assessment of what happened in this case?
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. I mean, as I said, I had not really been to any major cities in North Carolina. I'd been over to Virginia a little. We would go up to Virginia Beach every once in a while during the summer. And we had some family in the Chesapeake area of Virginia. But I had not been to a North Carolina city of any real significance. And so being in Durham, going to North Carolina Central, interacting with people, and there were people there at Central who were from all over the country. I mean, that was what was really fascinating. I was a first-generation college student, but there were students at Central whose parents had gone to Central, grandparents had gone to Central, and I'll say even fourth generation. At the time I was there, there was no place else they were going to go. And so you got exposed to students from D.C., from Maryland, Baltimore, you know, from all over North Carolina, Charlotte, Fayetteville, you know, from everywhere. I mean, it was just an eye-opening experience. You know, you had people from North Carolina and from rural North Carolina, from urban North Carolina, and then from all over the United States, even places like Chicago. So it was a fascinating experience, you know, and it really had an impact, plus the faculty who were very supportive and very interested in trying to see you succeed.
So talk about a little bit more about that, this transition into history. Had you considered that before, or, you know, what was your thinking as you decided, okay, this is it, I'm going to go try to get a master's in history?
Well, no, I really hadn't thought about history. I told you, we took our family history and community history for granted. And so even at that point, when I started my master's, I had not really thought about my community beyond, you know, just being a safe, warm, unique place that I enjoy. But while I was in graduate school, I took a North Carolina history course. And at the time, the book that we used was by Leffler and Newsom, The History of a Southern State of North Carolina, massive volume of about 600 pages, I say between 500 and 600 pages. But in the first chapter, they talked about the Tuscarora, and they talked about the Tuscarora War, and then they mentioned Indian Woods by name as a reservation that was given to the Tuscarora Indians at the close of the Tuscarora War. And it struck me that if my little hometown, my little community, where we were just, you know, we were just poor farming folk, was significant enough to be in this history textbook by these two great scholars at UNC Chapel Hill, then it must be significant. And that's what, you know, inspired me to actually get into writing about that community in particular. And at Central, you had to complete a master's thesis. And I asked my major professor, I mean, I said, well, I don't know what to write about. I said, can I write about my hometown? And his remarks were that if you don't write about it, nobody else will. And so that's how I ended up writing my master's thesis on Indian Woods and began that journey of self-discovery and understanding who, you know, what this community was really all about and who these people really were.
What's that like for you? I mean, sort of on the one hand, it's great to hear now I've got a subject, I've got a topic for my master's thesis, and it can be my hometown. But then you've got to make this transition in your mind from, you know, literally the ground you walked on to this academic view, this more objective view of a place that you lived all your life. Was that a difficult change of perspective for you when you had to look at Indian Woods academically?
Well, I would say actually not as much as you would think, because the professors, particularly my major professor, Dr. Bishop, he made certain that I was objective and that I walked the line. But for me, it was really wonderful to be able to go back and then start talking to local people to understand more about the history of the area. And most didn't know a lot about the Tuscaroras. They had heard the name before, and a couple of the older people would say, oh yeah, and they came back, I remember them coming back. Or the really older people would say, oh yeah, you know, we know that we're part, you know, yeah, my, you know, grandfather used to talk about that. So it was really speaking with people in a different way, whereas before you were just saying, hi, how are you doing? Is there anything I can do for you? My mother asked me to bring you these tomatoes or whatever, and oh, you take these eggs back to your mom, kind of thing, to, you know, now people were, you know, willing to talk a little bit about their lives. And then, of course, the rest, you know, you went to the archives, you pulled the colonial records from North Carolina, and they have, you know, information about the war, information about the various chiefs, about the treaties in terms of what, how they negotiated. So, and then you go to the courthouse and all of the leases are there and all of the individuals who leased land from the Indians are there. So the research part of it was guided by the professor and by the committee. And then the personal discovery was now looking at the people who I'd known all my life, and my grandfather. He was very excited about the fact that now someone in the family cared about family history, and someone in the family wanted to write family history. So it wasn't hard getting community people, particularly my grandfather, to guide and to assist me in taking me to places that I had, you know, passed all my life, yeah, but never really thought about, because I wasn't writing the history. So there were people who knew the history and wanted, and was glad to know, were glad to know that somebody cared enough to try to write it down and try to preserve it, because most young people are doing what most young people do. You know, most of the people who really get interested in history tend to be older people. You know, they care about their genealogy and they're trying to research their family history. But a lot of the younger people don't really have that interest. And our community was no different.
Well, we'll talk about what you learned when my conversation with Arwin Smallwood continues, a professor and chair of the Department of History and Political Science at North Carolina A&T. Our conversation continues on the state of things in just a moment. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Indian Woods, North Carolina, rural community in the northeastern part of the state. Not very big and not very many people live there, but the town is central to Arwin Smallwood's research. He wrote his doctoral dissertation about the community and its unique cultural and triracial mix. It's also where he grew up. Today, Arwin Smallwood is professor and chair of the Department of History and Political Science at North Carolina A&T. So you talked a little bit about the Tuscarora, the fact that there was a reservation there and that this was they were part of the Iroquois Confederacy. But tell us more about the Tuscarora and where they ended up.
Well, at one time, the Tuscarora pretty much, you know, through trade and, you know, territorially controlled access to North Carolina from the coast up into the Piedmont and even into the mountains. As they fought wars with the colonists, they got pushed up into the Piedmont. And you'll see in old maps that they're in Southern Virginia and here in and around Forsyth County, what is Winston-Salem, and also Guilford County. And if you know the history of the Iroquois, you know that the Iroquois were on good terms with the Quakers in Pennsylvania. And so the Quakers in Guilford County had relations with the Quakers in Pennsylvania. And so there is a story there that really hasn't been told. And the same thing with the Moravians in Winston-Salem. Six Nations had great respect for the Moravians and interacted with them in their territories in the Northeast as well. So that's another story. But the Tuscaroras, to me, were kind of left out of history or erased from history. I know growing up as a child, I never heard anything about the Tuscaroras in my high school or in college, other than reading that book, Leffler and Newsom's book, and knowing that Indian Woods was a reservation given to them after the war, and that was pretty much it. And so when I started trying to learn more about the Tuscarora, I was amazed that they were the sixth nation of the Iroquois Confederacy, and that the Iroquois Confederacy was the most powerful Indian confederacy in the history of North America, that the Great Law basically is served as, you know, as the foundation for the U.S. Constitution, and that the Iroquois had fought in all wars, French and Indian Wars, the Revolutionary War, even the Civil War, Six Nations siding with the Union. And of course, when Lee gave his surrender at Appomattox, the person who took his surrender was Eli Parker, who was a Seneca Indian, one of the members of the Six Nations. So the Tuscaroras were a fascinating people, and they were a very, you know, they were scattered, you know, after the war. It's like taking a mirror and shattering it. And they were scattered all over the eastern United States. And I found communities named Tuscarora in Illinois, in eastern Ohio, in Oklahoma, West Virginia, Virginia, throughout North Carolina. Many of the Lumbees and Robeson County, a great number of them claim Tuscarora ancestry, and even have connections to the Lowry family and others to Indian Woods. So it's important to understand that, you know, yeah, there was just a lot I did not realize. Mm-hmm. And as I started researching this, I just was amazed at how prolific they were and, you know, how significant they were to the Confederacy. Yet no one in North Carolina knew very much about them. There was more talked about them in New York and in Pennsylvania and at the American Philosophical Society in Philadelphia than here in North Carolina.
And when you say Confederacy, you mean the Iroquois Confederacy and not the Southern states, right, when you're talking about the Confederacy.
That is correct.
Yeah. I just want to wait, because the Iroquois Confederacy did actually officially sign on with the Union during the Civil War. And as you said, the idea of democracy, I mean, one of the great lies of Manifest Destiny was that the Europeans brought civilization to this great land. Except that they didn't know a thing about democracy when they got here until they talked to the Iroquois. And that confederation was actually, as you say, the template for our U.S. Constitution. So we learned from them how to govern our own country. And all this stuff, as you say, I mean, they don't teach you that, you know, in school. So now you're discovering that. And also the way in which these communities came together and formed a kind of unique ecosystem in eastern North Carolina. Is that fair to say? European, African, and Native American.
Oh, yes. And I also have to add, you know, the kinsmen of the Tuscaroras, the Maharans, who still are in eastern North Carolina, in and around Ahoskie, the Nottoways, who are in Virginia, Southern Virginia, all Iroquois and all basically are derivatives. You know, they're connected with the Tuscaroras, and they had that Southeastern Confederation, and then they were all linked to the six, to the five nations to create the six nations. So just as a, because they, those nations still exist intact, and their relationships with African Americans has always been intact. I think very few people realize, and I'm digressing slightly, but I think it's important to understand the relationship between, you know, Southeast Virginia and Northeast North Carolina. But Nat Turner, which is a name that's very familiar with many people, I don't think most would realize that his great-great-granddaughter, Chief Lynette Austin, is chief of the Nottoway Nation today, that they consider him native. And so, and on down from there, right on through into Northeastern North Carolina, you know, Northampton, Halifax, but down into the Siponies over in Halifax, but down into Hertford County and then into Bertie, and then on down south on 11 and 13, you end up in Robeson County and some of those other counties down there as well. But certainly the relationship between the Tuscaroras and Native people in general and Africans is also one of the understood and researched and written about histories. And it's pretty profound.
Well, tell us more about that. I know you mentioned the Tuscarora were implicated in a slave revolt early on, but what are some of the other things that we should know about that relationship?
Well, the Tuscaroras and the Iroquois in general, Mohawks, you know, and most people will have heard of Mohawk, but the Oneidas and the Cayugas and Onondagas may not be quite as familiar to them, or Senecas. But the Iroquois never returned runaway slaves. You know, all of the colonies owned slaves, New York, you know, Massachusetts, and on down into Pennsylvania. And during the early period, when slaves ran away, the Iroquois controlled everything on the frontier and in the backcountry. And the Tuscaroras, of course, the same here in North Carolina. They never returned these slaves. They would, you know, take them into their nations, they would adopt them, and they would end up intermarrying with them. And the Tuscaroras did the same. And so, and then after the Tuscarora War, those who were left on the reservation, you know, would harbor runaway slaves. They would hide them on the reservation. They would intermarry with them. And then since they knew the way to New York, and that's where the Tuscaroras, they became refugees after the war, and they fled North Carolina for New York and were taken in by the Oneidas and became the sixth nation of the Iroquois Confederacy. But there were also some taken in by the Mohawks at Ganawage, which is a Mohawk reservation outside of Montreal in Canada. And so you had Tuscaroras from North Carolina who migrated up in the 1700s, and they wanted their people back. So they would come back with other members of the Six Nations to get their enslaved people. And even if they had been mixed with Africans, they would get their people and they would take them back. So they were really some of the first people to operate the Underground Railroad. And when we talk about the Quakers and the Quakers' relationship with these, you know, with the Six Nations, you can really see, you know, that this good relationship that they had with the Quakers and where the Quaker settlements are, and then the Indian trading paths like the Tuscarora Trail, you begin to understand the relationship that Native people had with people who were anti-slavery, who were opposed to slavery. Because oftentimes when, you know, you, if slaves went on to Indian reservations or communities of Indians, it didn't have to always be an official reservation. It was just a community where Indians lived. The Indians wouldn't give those people over to slave catchers. And the slave catchers, at least as individuals, would tend to steer away from going into those areas which where they knew there were large numbers of Native people.
Fascinating stuff. You also made, as part of your study, a look at slavery in that area by looking at slave documents and deeds and other kinds of documents that give us a richer look at that period. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, and one of the things that the slave deeds do, if you look at the slave deeds, particularly the early deeds in the 1600s and 1700s, one of the things that you'll come across is you'll see a lot of slaves who are being described as mulattoes. And you have to understand that mulatto was really, we assume a mulatto is a mix between an African and a white, but actually mulattoes were seen as mixes between Indians and Africans. And you could be Indian and African, Indian, African, and white, triracial, or Indian and black, Indian and black, or Indian and white, or African and white. So when you see the term mulatto in these slave deeds, Oftentimes, what that's already indicating is that these slaves were of mixed heritage. And you'll even see in some of the runaway slave advertisements, they will even specifically say that the slave is, it's a mongrel, it's a mix between Tuscarora, white, and African. And so you'll see these, they describe what the slaves look like. You know, they'll say they're yellowish, or they, you know, are reddish. You know, they have, they're dark skinned, they may have blue eyes. I mean, so they do these slave advertisements, which are in the newspapers, and then also the slave deeds are describing what the slaves look like, and they're describing, in many cases, you know, the mixed heritage of the slaves. And so I do think that that's one of the things that people have to understand, that really the first peoples that were enslaved in North Carolina, Virginia, South Carolina, they were Native people. And, there was a brisk Native American slave trade. Alan Gillay's book, The Native American Slave Trade, talks about, you know, slaves being shipped from North America to the British Caribbean, and then the mixing of slaves with Africans in South Carolina, North Carolina, and Virginia. And then, of course, once that ends, then you see the influx of more and more Africans. But at the base of the slave system, particularly in North Carolina, you have natives, and a lot of those natives were Tuscaroras.
So important that we know this history, and so good that you're here to tell us about it and to continue the research. Research that you started when you started writing about Indian Woods in your master's thesis at North Carolina Central, you were focusing at that point on your father's community activism. What kind of organizing work did he do?
Well, my father was well-liked by, and I hope and think still even today, well-liked by all of the people in the community. He was just a good man. You know, he got along well with people, and he had a great concern about the young people having activities and having things to do. And so as the story goes, I mean, he was coming home from work, and he was a laborer. He worked in the lumber industry. You know, a lot of the folks in eastern North Carolina worked in what we call logwood. You know, they were logging. If you didn't work on a farm, you worked in logwood. And so he came home from work one day, and he saw that the young people in the community were playing baseball, but they were running to stumps. They had stumps as bases. And he thought how dangerous that was, that they were running in this cut forest and running to stumps and over stumps to get to them. And so he wanted to have a recreation center for him, a ballpark for them. So he got together with a lot of the local people, and he went to the churches. There are four churches that make up Indian Woods. And he talked to the church congregations, on Sundays, and they gathered money together, and he purchased land in the community's name to build a recreation center. And there they put, baseball fields in for a big league team and a little league team. And then they also put in, swings and slides, in an area for the kids to play. So, he was really about community. And again, he exemplified the fact that the community and the people in it were family, and he treated everyone as family. And I dare say that there were anyone who did not like my father. My father was just a very likable person, and he would do anything, for the young people or older people. He would often take firewood to the older people, and if someone needed assistance, he would help them.
Well, talk about the impact.
His interest was in trying.
Just talk about the impact it had, because I know that your father passed away when you were a freshman in college, and that had a big impact on you, did it not?
Oh yeah, tremendous. I was already first generation college. Going to college. And so Upward Bound, it kind of helped me to a certain extent. But, you can be prepared, but only to a point. And you still have to navigate this new world. And my father became ill with lung cancer while I was in my freshman year. And of course, even now, but then lung cancer was not, if you got that diagnosis, you really, there was no way to really stop it. And it was had progressed pretty far. And so he died in 1985, just before Christmas of 1985. And so that was pretty devastating. I, at the time, didn't really know a lot about depression and how people handle depression. You just kind of keep moving on, you keep pushing on. But I didn't do very well. I did not do well in school that following two semesters because of that. And and because of that, I did fail. And I did lose my financial aid and would have had to leave school had it not been for, and I have to, say this, my best friend, who we've been friends over 30 some years, but we met as freshmen in college. And, you know, he basically supported me, you know, for, you know, at least a semester to get myself together and finally get my grades back up and get my financial aid back. But you know, events happen in your lives that can be difficult, and we all face challenges. It's how you, you know, respond to those challenges, and oftentimes, you know, it's really the support of other people that get you through those challenges.
Well,
I have to really give a shout out to my roommate.
Yeah, your roommate and the rest of the communities that I think has been the theme of this whole program, the way that community support keeps everything going in the worst of times. And it's something that you bring forward by bringing your students to Eastern North Carolina to share some of this research, but actually putting their boots on the ground to see it. I didn't leave you much time for this, but why is it so important to bring them to that region?
I think it's important for them to see it. One of the things that I think informs me as a professor and as a teacher of history is to have actually walked the fields that my ancestors walked the fields that the sharecroppers and tenant farmers walked the fields that slaves walked. So actually seeing the landscape, and when I've taken students down and they see, well, we go all the way down to Nag's Head and we go to Roanoke Island and we go through and past the Albemarle Sound into Edenton, they see the vastness of the landscape and the waterways and the massive bodies of water. And it really helps them understand slavery in a different way in terms of escape and trying to escape slavery. I mean, just by looking at the swamps and the nature of the landscape, but also just understanding what the slaves endured, everything from mosquitoes and biting flies to snakes, and to just, you know, a landscape that can be both beautiful and then at the same time inhospitable. And so I think it's important that people go. And if you're writing about something, you need to go and see that area, see those people, talk to those people to get a real understanding of that experience.
Arwin Smallwood is a professor and chair of the Department of History and Political Science at North Carolina A&T. Always a pleasure. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The State of Things. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.